So I remember being in the Airbnb and I was like, hey guys, like the first part of the collection's live. And I'm like, I'm going to go take a shower. And I'm like, yeah, this will sell like in a few weeks, you know, they'll be hopefully. And if not, whatever. Because in the physical world, if something doesn't sell out immediately, no one loses their shit. I remember being in the shower. My husband like runs into the bathroom and he's like, they all sold. And I was like, all of them? There's like 200. And he was like, yeah. And I was like, I am so confused.
Hello and welcome to another special episode of Floorcast, the NFT podcast. Usually we have this weird talk showy style format with two or three other people, including myself, whose names usually begin with C, to talk through the biggest things that have happened in the NFT world on a weekly basis. But this time, we're going to do an interview with a prominent member of the NFT space. But before I introduce them, I do have a co-host with me. And yes, of course, their name does begin with a C. Christine, co-founder of Floor.
Hey, Pat. I sometimes joke that, you know, one of the requirements for me having this job, co-founder of Floor and co-host of this podcast, this wonderful podcast, is that my name begins with C. So fun fact, changed my name to make it happen.
Need to figure out what's going on at Floor in terms of that hiring process and whether or not like the candidates that are just coming in. It's like first come, first serve, but it's in alphabetical order.
Yeah. And we filter for C's. So like if you apply, your name begins with C, you get the job. That's all it is.
Bonus if there's a Chris in the name, right?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Well, listen, let's introduce our second ever interviewee on the Floorcast, Amber Vittoria. How are you?
Hi, thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
We're really excited to have you. You've recently moved out onto the West Coast in LA. How's the sunny life out there treating you?
It's so much warmer out here. It's so nice to be able to go on a walk and not freeze and not have to worry about checking the weather every single day. Yeah, it's been awesome.
So I recently went from London to Toronto for 3 months, and that has been like everything you just said, but the opposite. I'm constantly walking around like holding my nose so it doesn't fall off. Yeah, I've never seen anything like it.
You did it wrong. I feel like wrong season.
Some people love the winter. You know, they thrive in the cold. I unfortunately am not one of them.
So I am one of those people. The forecast this week is actually going back to like normal winter weather for New York and a little bit of rain. And I got really excited on Sunday and like went and like soup shopping, getting all my ingredients to make soups and chilies and cozy. I love it. Pet's like, no, you're wrong.
Yes, I love chili though, but you know.
I do love chili as well. Yeah, but just, I can also have chili in the warm. I don't know.
Wait, what?
Yeah, same.
Yeah, yeah, 100%. It's not like a, yeah, I'd love to have this in the summer, but I don't ever. Soups, I understand, but a chili.
I can have any time of year.
Yeah, easy.
Interesting. Definitely. Okay, I'm going to have to try it.
Should have like 90 degree weather in like August and be like, this is terrible. But like, well, not that day.
I'm going to text you both. It's going to be 100 degrees. I'm going to be cooking chili in my house and I'm going to be like, I regret this.
Like, this is gross.
And you can only have it for one portion because it's obviously gone off by the time, you know, the next day, fridge or not. Yeah. Well, that, you know, that took an interesting food turn. Usually, by the way, Amber, the rabbit holes we get into are more on the weather. So the first track we were talking about was definitely bang on. But yeah, I think let's get straight into it. I mean, for listeners who have listened to the only ever interview that we've done before with Zeneca so far this year, we'd like to talk about the kind of past, present, and the future for the interviewee. So let's rewind to pre-Web3. How did you find this weird and wonderful world, Amber?
And so before learning about Web3, I was and still am a freelance commercial artist. My work is abstract, so I'm very fortunate that a lot of brands will brief me in with my own work to make artwork for advertising or product. And right around when I started freelancing full-time in late 2017, I learned about Bitcoin and then probably shortly thereafter Ethereum and put a little bit of money into it just because I thought that the technology would eventually affect my life. I didn't think that it would happen so quickly after, but a few years later, during the pandemic, I learned about NFTs through my husband and then just articles being written about how artists are being able to support themselves by selling these digital collectibles. And that's really what piqued my interest and helped kind of change the way my practice is run. So Even though I still do a good amount of commercial work, it's been really nice to be able to prioritize fine art because of NFTs.
What has it been like going from kind of commercial clients and like one larger client to having a collection that is direct to a whole bunch of, you know, individual collectors that you don't know potentially, who aren't doxxed, who are just wallets on the other side of it for the most part? Like, has that been difficult, easy for you?
In the beginning, it was a little more difficult because I was selling pieces that were physical that had the NFT component. And a lot of people were uncomfortable sharing a mailing address, which I get. You know, you're like, I don't know you, you don't know me. So I kind of paused after selling a few of them, which I was really grateful for. And then I started to realize that digital artwork was what was really resonating with a lot of folks. You didn't have to worry about mailing it. The original was the NFT. And I, before NFTs, would make digital work for my clients, even though I paint predominantly. I do digital iterations just because it's easier for it to be printed on garments or printed for like an out-of-home billboard or what have you. So I was like, well, I'll just do my digital work and I'll see if it resonates. And that's kind of what was an easier entry point for me. And then as people got to know me as a person and know that I wasn't going to like show up at their house, they started to trust. And like, I was able to sell, you know, paintings and physical prints with my works as well. So that's been really nice. But yeah, in the beginning, it was a little bit tough because people were like, who are you? And I'm like, I'm not going to show up at your house. Also, now you have my address on the mailing label too. But I think over time, and I also hear that like a lot of platforms are trying to build for this where if someone does collect it, they can, you know, privately enter their information. That way they feel a little bit more secure. But I feel like with anything new, there's always fun challenges and hurdles to kind of overcome and, you know, adjust to.
Yeah, outside of the like trust kind of barrier that you have there of like, okay, who am I? What do I do? Am I going to show up at your house? Do you find there to be any differences between digital collectors and physical collectors in terms of like what they're looking for, what they're interested in, like how they buy, where they buy? Or are we just all kind of the same in different platforms?
When I first started, I assumed we were all kind of the same. And then I quickly learned that's not the case. Usually when I sell my paintings or limited editions or unlimited editions of my work in the physical space, people buy them because they want to collect them, usually to put somewhere in their home. Whereas for Web3, a lot of people will collect to speculate, which was something new for me. I was like, "What? Why are you short-term flipping my work? I'm so confused. Like, what is happening?" And so kind of grappling with that has definitely been a learning curve. I'd say not only for me, for a lot of artists, because majority of us say like, hey, you're collecting my work as an NFT very similarly to as if you were to collect my work physically, like, you know, teach their own. But, you know, ideally, you're not speculating on it. You're collecting it because it resonates with you. So obviously, everyone could buy things for whatever reasons they want to. But in Web3, a lot of people, I think, push back if, you know, your artwork doesn't moon for them in 24 hours, which has been a new interpersonal experience I didn't really have experience prior to Web3. So definitely still working through that.
How do you grapple with that? Like, if there were a piece of advice or, I don't know, a set of wisdom that you would pass on to an artist who's going through that for the first time, like, how do you manage it?
A lot of times I just point them to my Discord, which clearly states that. I also reiterate that too, like, you know, you're collecting my work as if you were to be collecting it physically. You know, it's an artwork, you know, it's not a token, it's not a project or a company, you know, this is an artwork. And if you're going to collect it to speculate, then that accountability is on you. And people usually don't like that response. But I try to make it very clear in the upfront, especially over the last 2 years, that's like, if you're collecting my work, regardless of what medium it's in, it's artwork, full stop. Yeah. And I think over time, people will start, as more people enter that aren't here to, you know, make a quick flip, that will be a lot easier and more palatable. But for right now, there's definitely still a bit of friction there. So I'd say to an artist, just, you know, stick to your guns. A lot of people are going to give you a lot of unsolicited advice because they want their bags to moon. And if you're artwork is a part of their bags, then they're going to want to tell you how to run your business. But you know what's best for you. And if you stick with that, you'll be all right.
Yeah. It feels like a crazy amount of pressure between having to figure out how to actually get your art on the blockchain to how to market it, how to price it, how to actually go through a mint, which has its own weird set of dynamics, to then managing a set of collectors that have way different potential interests from like, hey, it truly speaks to me and I want to have this on my wall, in my wallet, in my life, to like, yeah, 24 hours later, I want to see profit. It's a lot.
Yeah, it definitely runs the gamut. And, you know, over time, it'll settle down. But it's such a new space. So it's to be expected, I think.
You started in going from pre-Web3 to Web3, Amber. What has been your favorite part of it? Like, what about NFTs and digital art has opened a door, opened a possibility that you wouldn't have had just doing commercial work or physical work?
I would say connecting with people that probably otherwise wouldn't have heard of me or my work at all. To have people that live across the globe collect my work and resonate with different paintings of mine has truly been the best part of this space.
Yeah. And your work is so distinctive. I think that that's like, I know the floor community and broadly, like really it resonates with them and they're excited about it. I count myself among that group. I love your distinctive style. Like, how did you come into that? Has that been something that you've carried through prior to NFTs, or is that something that kind of you've iterated on and the digital format has helped unlock a little bit more?
I would say that for when I first started working for myself, and even before when I was doing part freelance and working full time as an art director, my work started off pretty figurative. And I mean, this is not unique. If you look at a lot of abstract artists, they all start off figurative for the most part. And then over time, so my figurative work was inspired by the fact that I couldn't really see myself in art or in advertising. And I wanted to make figures that I could see myself in. And then over time, that work evolved to be a more emotional aspect of representation and less of a physical one. And thus the forms that I was painting were growing to be a bit more abstract. And then over time, I realized I was like, this lives best not in a human form at all. And and that was over the period of several years. And working digitally definitely inspires my hand-painted work and vice versa. I think that sometimes you work in a different medium and it kind of shakes you loose and it lets you unlock something that you wouldn't have if you were still working in one particular medium, at least for me. So I like to kind of oscillate between the two. And they definitely inform each other over time. And it's really fun to see collections. Like, I have a collection that I released a year and a half ago called It's Because You're Pretty. And that's digital. And it's funny to look back at it because a lot of those pieces inspire a lot of my painted work that I currently do.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, so it's really nice to kind of see that even though I evolve as a person and as an artist over time, sometimes I go back to earlier forms of myself and then build upon them. So it's pretty cool.
That's cool, being able to like actually tie all the threads together and see how things interact.
I wanted to ask, you know, you talked about that kind of emotional attachment that buyers of your art, because they're NFTs, have, rather than, you know, with traditional art or even digital print, you might have someone that purchases someone and never interacts with the artist again. And it's on their wall, they know who you are, but they don't have that kind of closer tie-in. The question I wanted to ask is, what was that feeling like when you first sold your art online as NFTs, like that first mint out feeling? And do you recall, like, emotionally whether or not that was different to, you know, getting client work or selling some art in more traditional means?
Yeah, I would say the first big memory was when I did my Alphabet collection almost 2 years ago. Yeah, which is wild. Just because they sold so quickly, and that I just, especially Twitter, I didn't have a Twitter following back then. I mean, I still have a small one, but it was just bizarre to me. I was like, what is happening here? What's like, this is so quick. Like, I remember we were in Utah. We were during the pandemic, we drove from New York to LA. I don't know if that was part of that. No, it wasn't. It was just separate. My goal is to see all the national parks. So we were in Utah to see, I believe it was Arches. Anyway, so I remember being in the Airbnb and I was like, hey guys, like the first part of the collection's live. And I'm like, I'm going to go take a shower. And I'm like, yeah, this will sell like in a few weeks, you know, they'll be hopefully. And if not, whatever. Because in the physical world, if something doesn't sell out immediately, no one loses their shit. And I remember being in the shower. My husband like runs into the bathroom and he's like, they all sold. And I was like, all of them? There's like 200. And he was like, yeah. And I was like, I am so confused. Obviously, in hindsight, you know, a lot of people speculate. A lot of people will track volume on contracts over time. So if it's a high volume. So like, I didn't know that back then. And I was like, wow, so many people resonated with this collection. This is so exciting. So that was really great. But in hindsight, I'm like, they're there. You have no idea. but it was definitely really exciting because it was the first, it was a boost of confidence to be like, wow, people do view my work as fine art and want to collect it. And I still feel like that overall, even though I feel like with a lot of the earlier collections, people were more speculating than they were collecting. But there are a lot of people that collected from that alphabet collection that still hold and cherish the letters that they collected, which is really nice.
Can I ask as well, like when you were looking back at, you know, at the time, you must have been like, okay, this is amazing, incredible. But like, how did this happen? Like, what was the trigger? Did someone tweet about it? Did, you know, were people, you know, crypto sleuths like looking at smart contracts and looking at which ones were getting the biggest volume mints? Like, what was it that triggered the sellout while you were having a quick shower?
I think a combination, but I do like to thank Franklin and Alona. They're both collectors in the space, and they found my work through a woman named Cara, who's another artist that followed me on Instagram, being like, hey, I love this artist. She's selling NFTs now. So Franklin and Alona collected a few of my inaugural collection, I called it. And then when the Alphabet collection came out, they tweeted it. And I think that that was really helpful to just kind of share the work to other people that didn't follow me. But I think it was a combination of things. And then as people minted them, they shared it on social and, you know, people that liked it then went in and minted it too. But yeah, that was the first time that I was like, this is very quick to sell work, which then eventually became an expectation, I think, for a lot of artists to sell out quickly. And I hope over time that goes away because it's unsustainable. Like, it's okay to let things sit. But you hear interviews like this and people on Twitter are like, yeah, I'm all sold out on all platforms. And artists that aren't are afraid to share more work. And it's like a lot of my physical work sits for a while. Like I have some work with Uprise Art Gallery and it'll sit until it finds its home. You know, if it's big or it's, you know, an odd shape or like, you know, I just think that hopefully we'll normalize the fact that that's not normal and it's okay to have things sit. So I say that with the caveat.
I think that's a perfect transition into the present as well, because one of the things that I've seen you experiment with over the past few months, if not longer, is editions, whether that's editions in your mint or even open editions. And I think you right now have like a forever open edition, like no cap in supply, no cap in time, that is meant to kind of like be the opposite to that. That kind of like, oh, you need to mint out, you need to do like, it needs to move fast. How has that been for you? And kind of what are you seeing right now in the open edition trend?
Yeah, I love editioning. I studied printmaking in college and I started doing limited editions of my paintings as NFTs about a year ago, a little over a year ago. And those were fantastic, but still the pressure to like sell them out quickly was there. Over time, technology allowed for timed editions and for open editions, which a lot of people in the NFT space kind of confuse the language. And then when someone like me tries to educate them on the language, they get mad. They're like, you're wrong. It's just cultural. Like, no, like editioning has been around for a while and there are words that make things clearer. So a lot of people say open edition and they don't realize that if an edition is closed by anything, it's not open. I know that that sounds like common sense, but if it's closed by time or if it's closed by number, it's not an open edition. Open editions in the physical world, you just don't know the edition number or the cap. So like Cause has a bunch of vinyl collectibles that are all open edition. You just don't know how many there are. That's why they're more accessible and affordable. And then timed editions, I've seen a good one by Stephen Harrington where he's like, you order this print for 72 hours, that'll be the edition size. So these things also exist in the physical world. So I'm definitely the curmudgeon that's like, it's easier to be clear with what you're trying to communicate because it makes it easier for those that want to collect to know what they're collecting. So anyway, long way of saying that I think editioning is a great way to provide accessibility to an artist's work. Limited editions can be smaller and less accessible, timed editions, because it's how much time you want to leave it open for, could be a little more accessible than limited. And then an open edition that is, you know, ongoing in the NFT space could be the most accessible for people. So I think it's a great way for artists to, you know, tap into all different types of collectors that love their work that might not be able to afford a painting or a limited edition, but, you know, they can have a piece from an open edition that they cherish, which is nice. I also do think that it does get rid of the hype and the sellout, especially the unlimited edition, because it's purely for the art. If people want to collect it, they can. They're not trying to speculate. It kind of rids that collection of speculator. And there's nothing wrong with speculating or flipping. I just think the biggest issue is that those that do speculate and do flip don't take accountability for their decision making. They push it onto the creator. And I think that's the biggest issue, is that a lot of creators and project founders and company founders get a lot of heat when, you know, flippers can't make their flip, which in the physical world, that doesn't happen. You know, you buy a Chanel bag and it's not the it bag or size of the season. Well, that's on you, you know. You're not going to go yell at Chanel customer service for not being able to flip their product after you bought it. So I do think editioning kind of allows that hype to mellow out a little bit, which is exciting, I think, in the long term.
I think one trend that I have watched and not fully understood, I am one of the people that like did not get into the, like the checks ecosystem that has been kind of buzzing for the past month. Like it's been beautiful to watch from the outside, and like the energy and invigoration in the space of like creativity and permissionless ownership. Like, I love it. But I also, like, I have not gone deep into things like burning to say like, okay, there's an edition, potentially an open edition. You can mint dozens of this thing, and then there will be a mechanic down the line to actually trade those in somehow for another thing. Have you used the burning mechanism at all in your work? Like, have any thoughts on it as a like meta right now?
Yeah, I haven't followed checks very closely, even though it's widely popular, which is great. So I think that's from the outside. Like you said, it seems like a really nice hybrid of art and mechanics and design in a way. I believe that the creator of them is a designer. I could be mistaken. So that's really fun because, you know, it can change and evolve over time and almost is kind of like a performance in a way, which is cool. I've done burning twice, and usually it's for pieces that are thematically tied, whether they were made around the same period of time or one is in conversation with another. So I use that as a mechanic. I've only used it twice, and I don't have an intention to use it in the near future, but I like to use it if it helps drive the story. A lot of my work is very storytelling oriented, and the content of my work heavily relies on story. So if it makes sense for the story, I'll do it. I don't like doing things for the sake of popularity. Usually I'm a little late to the popularity game because I'm like, okay, let the hype die. And then if it makes sense for something, I'll do it. So for burning, that is a good example of that, where it's like, if it makes sense, I'll do it. And if it doesn't, then it's always good to keep in your back pocket if it ever does make sense in the future.
Yeah, I love that approach. Is there anything out of the last 2 years that you look at specifically and you're like, it was really hypey at one time, and once the hype died down, I was really excited to like go into it and make it my own and work with this thing that like felt like it had a moment?
I would say the opposite. I did editions for a long time, and I started doing timed editions, and then they became really hyped. And then people got mad after that. They're like, why can't I flip the time edition? And I was like, oh boy. But I still use them because I think that they're a great way for accessibility and to, you know, rid the pressure of sellout. But yeah, the opposite is like, I love editioning. No one's ready for it. I'm going to do them anyway because I like them. And then they became more popular, and then now they're starting to fade out. I'm like, I'm going to still do them because I still like it.
Yeah. I really loved your, I think it was in December, the collection Untitled that you minted that had like the dynamic in it was very cool, where there were one of ones and there were one of fives and one of 15s, I believe, or there were editions within the collection, but when you minted, you didn't know if you were minting an edition or not an edition. And it just felt like a very accessible way to approach art that people that maybe wouldn't otherwise have a chance to collect a one of one could. I don't know. How did you come up with that idea? Is it something you've done before? Is it something you're thinking about doing again?
So that was It was a really interesting idea that I had probably earlier in the summer, just because, as you know, at least in the United States, the economy was slowing, and mm-hmm. with inflation, a lot of folks were, you know, struggling to, you know, be able to support themselves, let alone buy artwork. So I wanted to have a collection where someone could have a chance to accessibly get a unique piece. And that's why I wanted to do that with MoonPay, because I could technologically do that on my own. That would be tough. So I really wanted an opportunity for people to be able to have a limited edition or a one of one, you know, without having to, you know, save up for mm-hmm. it. And I thought that was really nice, just because, like, as someone that also collects art, majority of the art I've collected are editions, because that's what is within my price range. So I thought that it was kind of like a nice nod to, you know, what was happening economically when that collection was coming out, then also, you know, give people a chance to get a one-on-one. I don't know if I would do it again, because it created speculation. I was like, I feel like everything that I try to do that's wholesome ends up getting turned on its head in this space. So hopefully over time that will change as well. But a lot of it turned into like hype and speculation, like, oh, I want a one-on-one. And then if they didn't get it, they would dump it. So it's definitely an interesting ecosystem to sell artwork in. And I'm always surprised. And I'm like, oh, I think this will be great. People that want to collect it will collect one. If they get a one-on-one, they'll be surprised. Fantastic. And where it turned out to be that a lot of people did speculate on it. So I don't know if I would do it again until more and more folks are collecting digital collectibles. I think right now it's still just very hype driven and very speculation driven, that I don't know if the ecosystem is ready for something that is meant to be a bit more wholesome.
Mm-hmm. I was going to ask a question just on that. You've mentioned the kind of flippers and the speculative nature of some people buying your artwork quite a bit. I guess it's a blessing and a curse, right? This ability to distribute your artwork in such a global way, in such a fast way compared to maybe some traditional means in art, is really great. But the other side of it has been, yeah, that speculative element. Is that ever something that's kind of put you off making your art? And then I think this will ladder in quite nicely into some of the royalty debate stuff that we might touch on in a minute. But I think this might be a pain point as well for a lot of artists, where they're constantly seeing lots of trading volume, which, even though monetarily might benefit them, might be detracting from the kind of beauty of collecting art.
Yeah, I think that the biggest sticking point for me is, I'm a big proponent of, like, you know, when you buy my work, it's yours, you know, do with it what you will. And whether you flip it or speculate on it, like, you know, you're an adult, you can take that accountability. I think the sticking point for me is when people don't take on that accountability. And I've collected a lot of NFTs that are worthless now, but they mean something to me because I collected it because I thought that it was beautiful or it resonated with me. Even if it is a PFP that's worth $5 and I spent $500 on it, and I just know and have the accountability that, like, I had that $500. I wanted to spend it on that NFT, and I did that with my spending money. What I get as an artist a lot of times is people that, I'm assuming, overextended themselves trying to make a quick buck off of NFTs with my art included in that. And when that doesn't pan out, they project that onto me and as a failure on my part. And I think that's the biggest issue. When you hear people talking about flippers are bad, flippers are good, it's like, you know, flippers exist in pretty much any type of market. It's just how folks in this space handle when their flip goes south is something that is detrimental to artists and creators. And I think that, again, over time, that's going to sort itself out and people will have to take their own accountability. People that are not in NFTs, and I tell them this, they're like, wait, they blame you because they couldn't profit off of the thing that they bought from you on their own accord in 24 hours? And I was like, yep, I get a lot of angry DMs. It's fun. It takes a little, it's not going to be profit. So I think that's the biggest sticking point. So, like, for me, it's like when I see trading volume, like, you know, people have to buy and sell for whatever reasons, so long that, you know, people take accountability for their own decisions when purchasing something, whether digital or physical, in their life. And then in terms of royalties, I think that that has been a very interesting conversation. I wish I had a crystal ball to see, like, where it turns out. But with OpenSea recently kind of changing their business model to allow it to kind of be more like tip-based, I guess, for lack of a better term, I think that it just kind of shows that society, you know, isn't ready for royalties within fine art yet. And there are a lot of industries that do pay out royalties for usage. Usually it's more commercial and less fine art in the United States, but I hope in time that that will kind of change back. But I think that just seeing so many people using Flutter and kind of circumventing royalties just shows that the ecosystem isn't ready for it yet, which is unfortunate. But
yeah, it's hard to watch sometimes because I think one of the like explanations I have this go-to speech in my back pocket when people are like, why NFTs? Like, why not just sell a digital file? And being able to say, oh, for example, like digital art, if it's on the blockchain, you can kind of have royalties go back to an artist. So if they sell it at $20 when they're not famous and they work for years and years and they become prominent and their early work is selling for a lot more, they can benefit for it and not just make the $10 from their early work when it was like lower priced. And that's a use case that like I think a lot of people like they click and they're like, oh yeah, I get that and I understand how this technology might facilitate that, even if it doesn't directly facilitate that, as we've learned. I know that you, when some of these marketplace kind of policies started shifting, and they've been shifting for a while, the ground kind of feels like it moves every other day.
Yeah.
You had a thread about like, you know, as a creator, there are ways to take some ownership and make sure you protect yourself outside of royalties. What are some of those things? I think one of the things that you mentioned is like preserving some of the creations that you kind of mint for yourself and having kind of your own treasury. And do you think that that's some, like those things are like reasonable things to ask of artists? Or do you think it's just like, this is a stopgap because the space that we're in right now doesn't have kind of all of the tools that we want when it comes to royalties and royalty enforcement?
Yeah, I think that it just, you know, takes a note from, you know, the world outside of NFTs where you don't have royalties at all when your work sells. Especially coming from a commercial background, I've never relied on royalties. And I think a lot of artists can say that as well, that the royalties isn't a huge part of their income. But still, even if it's 1 or 2% of your annual income, losing that can be really tough. And so I just wanted to provide, you know, alternative options for artists to kind of, you know, if they haven't thought about them already, like other things that they can do. So yeah. I own majority of my own paintings. I don't sell too many paintings. Same thing with editions. I try to hold on to a couple of each. Just, you know, in case that the stars align and, you know, my grandkids can sell them for a lot of money, like good for them, you know? But I do think that, royalties, I feel more for folks that, have like, you know, the 10K like PFP collections that, you know, they released 10,000 assets and, you know, now they're surviving off of the trading of those assets and having to provide and create new things to create hype around those same 10,000 assets. Like, that's really hard. I think that I feel for folks in that space. But as artists, you know, we continue to make work. We continue to sell our work, even though people tell us not to, keep everything rare, which is a whole other conversation. I think that it is a little bit softer of a blow. Again, I'm also trying to look at the silver linings too. I feel like, you know, as a woman in art, your whole lived experience is trying to find a silver lining. So I think that that's the way I'm trying to approach it, is that, like, you know, unfortunately, society's not ready for royalties. You know, what can I do to, you know, keep myself afloat? And so I just try to think outside of the box.
So we've touched on two of the three trends in the space, or at least emerging trends that we're seeing: open editions or editions generally, royalties. The last one that goes without saying is artificial intelligence. And while ChatGPT did not write these interview questions, I did ask it to, you know, I was like, hey, we're running a podcast with Amber Vittoria. Can you write a set of questions for that podcast? And it did, with stunning success. It was spooky.
Wait, seriously?
How it
when I type in my name to like DALL-E, it gives me butterflies. Crazy. It gives me butterflies when I type in my name. People are like, aren't you afraid AI is going to rip off your work? And I was like, no.
I'm literally scrolling back. I sent a screenshot to Pet. So question 5, you worked with a number of high profile clients, including the New York Times, Nike, Gucci. How do you approach collaborations with brands?
ChatGPT asked that?
You've been vocal about your commitment to diversity and inclusivity in art. Can you talk about why? Like, it was like, no, here are all the way. Things. The one that I was like, okay, this one really actually knows you is, your art is known for its vibrant colors and bold shapes. Can you talk about your creative process and how you approach the use of colors in your work? Maybe
holy
I should have
shit.
Let, maybe I should have let ChatGPT write this interview.
All
but
right. Dang. Okay.
Yeah, it was spooky. I guess, like, given how spooky it is, like, how are you seeing AI emerge in, like, your creative process, if at all? Like, how are you thinking about it as it kind of intersects with creation and creativity in the digital art space?
I think that a lot of art, it's funny because on Twitter, everyone's very like pro artificial intelligence. And then everyone I follow on Instagram that are artists are very anti. And I don't think people realize that artificial intelligence has been a part of a lot of, if you use Adobe, it's been a part of our practice for a minute. I remember back in college when I'd have the clone stamp things in the background forever. And now it just automatically does it. That's artificial intelligence. And so I think that it's just been evolving for a long period of time. So how I use it in my practice is I love to use it to explore different ideas. If I just like have an idea and I'm like, I don't know what that's going to look like. Or even if it's something that's out of the realm of like the work that I normally make, it's just really fun to kind of work with a tool that forces you to think outside of the box in a way that's really accessible. So I like doing that when, you know, I'm looking for, you know, inspiration. Sometimes I'll type in like things like national park photos if I can't get myself to a national park and just, you know, be inspired that way. So that's been really great. I haven't used ChatGPT. I see so many TikToks about how it's supposed to make your life easier. So eventually I'll get there. I just haven't, you know, found it a need yet. But I think it's really incredible because it's an assistant and a tool that can help you create what you want to create. Whether you're fully relying on it to create a visual piece of artwork or fully relying on it to create, you know, something musical or to help you with a presentation, or if you're using parts of it to kind of implement into your day-to-day life, I think that it's pretty incredible. Sometimes it gets a little scary, like those questions. You're like, okay, that's pretty helpful. But I think that it's only going, if we do it right, it'll be a supplement to our lives and our lived experiences. And the only hesitation I have is obviously AI pulls from, you know, everything that we've ever created. And a lot of that has bias. I feel like same thing with the internet and algorithms. Like we, you know, humans are biased against race, against gender, ability. And thus that will seep itself into artificial intelligence as well. So hopefully those that are building these platforms will, you know, obviously humans are flawed, but try to design, you know, beyond those flaws so it is an equal and equitable space for people. And that would be my one concern. So hopefully, you know, that will be implemented into artificial intelligence as it continues to evolve.
Yeah, I appreciate that thought and the approach that you take. I had someone describe how they were starting to use AI in their creative process is like, it's nice to have a partner that doesn't get bored bouncing ideas off of you, that you can kind of talk to about your thing for hours on end and just kind of like comes back at you with like a slight variation, or like you give it something creative and it kind of gives you something that you can then riff off of and you don't have to burn your personal relationships in doing that. And I was like,
yeah, that's true.
I think that's it. That's apt. That feels apt. I guess before we move on to the future, one of the things that we haven't really touched on, you know, we've talked about your past in commercial art and physical art and your transition into NFTs, but you're also a poet. You've also dabbled in generative art. Like you span a few like creative areas. I'd love to hear about like what that is like for you, how that creative process works, and you know, where you're finding your energy these days and like where it's focused.
Yeah. So poetry started to come about a few years ago. A lot of the titles of my pieces were very intricate, and then eventually they just grew into short form poem. So I usually like to tether my paintings with my poetry. And so that's been really exciting. But I would say with generative art, it was really fun to partner with Melissa Wiederecht, who she's a generative artist. So to create something together was really fun. Mm-hmm. That's actually one of my favorite collections. I have to print a few of the ones that I have and hang them somewhere. It's called In Due Time. And I've seen a few documentaries about how we're going to predict the end of our knowing of the universe or multiverse or whatever. And one of them is this wild YouTube video that tries to go so far into the future. And essentially just it's, you know, like death by ice, you know, everything is just particles floating. So the poem where it, I'm ad-libbing, so it's probably not 100%, is in due time, we will all be particles dancing across the skyline. And so it was really fun to work with Belissa on making something that felt like it was done by hand and something that was imperfect and something that allows for movement, especially because it's done digitally. I think oftentimes I try to be really clean and neat in my painted work. Not all the time. Sometimes I like to dabble with something messy just kind of to offset myself. But then when it comes to digital work, I really enjoy digital work that feels imperfect. And that's what I really wanted for a generative collection. So I felt like all of these things kind of added up to create something that was really meaningful.
Yeah, I love that. I love that there's kind of generally a level of precision in the physical and then kind of a handness, of hand-paintedness in the digital. Like that's a very cool comparison. Pet, any questions from you before we move on to future?
No, none from me. I think let us move to the future. But before we do that, I need to remind you that we're a community-led podcast by the Floor NFT app community. And if you don't know what Floor is, it's your very own NFT portfolio in your pocket, an app that aggregates all your NFTs into one amazing interface. So we talked about the present, and we've talked about the past also right up at the top of the show. Now let's talk a little bit about the future. What key trends do you see emerging in the NFT or digital art space in 2023, Amber?
I wish I knew. I think that's the beautiful thing about this space, right? Is that you're always taken by surprise. But trends that I hope to see happen would be people being a bit more intentional with what they're collecting. Folks kind of slowing down on, you know, hype-driven collecting, overextending themselves, speculation. There's nothing wrong with any of those things, but I think done in abundance can be troublesome, and I think we've seen that in the past. So my hope is that, you know, in 2023 and beyond, you know, people are a bit more intentional with what they're collecting and why. I hope that that continues on beyond 2023. That'd be nice to start to see that happen sooner rather than later.
And in the much more long-term horizon, which is funny to say because I think a lot of people outside of the space would think long-term is 20 years, but say 3 to 5 years, what are you excited about? Where do you hope your art and your kind of creativity goes?
In the next 3 to 5 years, just because I moved to Los Angeles and I have more than my kitchen table to paint on, which is very exciting. People are like, you led your own practice for years from a kitchen table. And I was like, yeah, man, humble beginning. So I now that I have a bit more space, I'd love to paint a bit larger. I have a few larger canvases, like 5 by 6 feet, that I would love to continue to paint and kind of get out in the world and then grow beyond there. Perhaps, you know, now that I'm in Los Angeles, where the weather is usually nice majority of the time, to be able to do murals could be nice. In New York, that's a lot tougher. But also to slow down myself and be more intentional with the work that I'm making, the work that I'm putting out. And I think, especially for the last 5+ years that I've been freelancing full time, I always like to experiment and try new things. And now that I've tried a lot of things, I think I really want to, you know, narrow in and be intentional with how I move forward with my work. I don't know exactly what that looks like yet, but, you know, that's something that I've been thinking of for the next 3 to 5 years. I would really love to have, you know, a few things that I schedule out and do. You know, whether it's like a limited edition print drop like 3 times a year or an NFT collection or NFT editions like 2x a year, something like that, be a lot more intentional and scheduled with my process. I think that could be really exciting. And I take inspiration from like CJ Hendry and Stephen Harrington and like how they conduct their practice, at least from the outside, you know, as a follower. And so trying to kind of reshape what I do in that way.
And we touched on this a little bit through our conversation around the present. What do you think people are wrong about now? And it could be something that we already touched on. It could be anything else. Like, is there something in the space that's being over-indexed in and that Web3 and the NFT kind of digital art collection community is too focused on?
I don't know about too focused on, but I'd say not focused on enough. A lot of people in this space pride themselves on being early and forward thinking. But you see a lot of the same patterns that, you know, we've seen outside of Web3. And a lot of them are societal and how they impact, you know, women and people of color. In the Web3 space, I would say that a lot of the artists that find the top tier of success tend to be male and white. And so my hope is that, you know, we broaden our horizons a little bit and, you know, give some spotlight to people that fall outside of that and to not kind of fall in line with how society has fell in line with art collecting, you know, for the last several decades and centuries. And so I'd like to see that a bit more. It's definitely difficult to talk about whenever I talk about it on social. I usually get tokenized where they're like, well, you're more successful on the guys I know. And I'm like, great, one white woman found success, solved sexism, you know what I mean? So I would hope that people, again, I think it falls back into the idea of being intentional and slowing down, can see that, you know, we're already falling into the same patterns that we have for decades past, which isn't surprising. You know, there's, you know, no specific blame for that just because that's how society is. But hopefully we could push beyond that. If we're the forward-thinking group of folks that we claim to be, I think that it's time to push beyond how society has operated thus far.
Yeah. I think Web3 to so many people is like a promise for more accessibility, for like bottoms up, like creation and organization, identity and community. It's like, okay, if we fulfill that, if we're going to be really intentional about fulfilling that, we need to give people who maybe look different than us, sound different than us, like that platform to really live up to what we hope the space could be.
Yeah. And I think it would make this space so much more exciting if like we're doing ourselves a disservice by only prioritizing certain types of art for certain types of communities, because there's so many more incredible stories from, you know, humanity to be told that are being told. It's just that we don't give that the attention that it deserves. So I think it'll happen over time. But that's something that I wish we could talk more on without, you know, people getting upset or disagreeing or kind of just saying that, you know, everything is fine when it, you know, when it definitely is a work in progress.
Can I ask a question on some emerging artists that have potentially reached out to you after seeing your success? Like, what are some of the advice that you give to the people that haven't been so early?
Yeah, a lot of people will DM me being like, should I sell NFTs? That's actually the first question. It's like, okay, and if I should, like, how do I do it? And I think there's a lot more resources now making that a lot more accessible. I think over time, it'll be even more accessible, especially with Instagram. I collaborated with them doing a digital collection for Leaf. I think if that becomes rolled out globally or even within certain countries, that makes it a lot more accessible. You just post a digital collectible as if you would post an Instagram post. I think more technology is going to make that easier. So that's why I tell people, I'm like, if you don't have the means or the resources to do the research now and figure it out, you know, on your own, and like I'll point people to like, what is a MetaMask? You know, how do I buy Ethereum? Like very beginning, I said, like, you can hold tight. Like it's going to be mainstream for everybody. I think similarly to when I wanted to sell prints and Society 6 didn't exist. And I was like, well, I can't do editions and keep them in my tiny Queens apartment. You know, like, what am I going to do? Like over time, you know, these gaps will be filled. But beyond that, folks that are a bit more savvy with blockchain technology and have ETH, and they're like, okay, I would like to sell my artwork. What is your advice? Usually I tell them, like, don't worry about selling out quickly. Don't worry about trying to be hyped. Just try to find people that resonate with your work. I think that's the best way forward. You'll get people that try to tell you how to, you know, run your practice and just, you know, stick to who you are. You're the artist. You've been doing this for a long time. Like, you know what's best for you. So that's usually what I tell people outside of all the technical things.
I think the Instagram point is really, really interesting because, I mean, there will be artists, I presume, that have hated NFTs up until this point, that in 2 years launch some. I think it's only
for sure.
Normal. I mean, there was an amazing story we covered. I don't know if you remember, Christine, on the Floorcast about this artist who'd done a lot of like pixelated art. And they said, they tweeted something like, I'm making $16,000 a year and I can hardly support myself. I'm going to try NFTs. I'm sorry if you hate me. And a load of the comments were like, don't do that. It's a scam, blah, 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 blah. and they sold out a bunch of their collections. They did really well. And they tweeted something like, this is crazy. Like, I've just made how much I usually make in a year in a week. I wanted to ask you, like, presuming you still have loads of contacts, loads of friends in the traditional art industry, what are some of the conversations you have where there's a bit of friction and tension around digital collectibles in general? Like, is there a frustration when you have those conversations? Or do you just kind of, what will be, and, you know, in 2 to 3 years, they'll probably be interacting with NFTs in some way?
I would say the negative friction was a lot in the beginning, especially when people were like, NFTs are killing the planet. You're a terrible person. You're burning all this energy. And you're like, and they would reference one article that was poorly written and poorly sourced.
By the way, I'm so glad that's now like completely in the mud after Proof of Stake. Like,
so after Proof of Stake, that kind of went away. A lot of people still do feel that it's scammy. And I'm like, well, scams exist everywhere. I get like 1,000 email scams a day. I get scam phone calls. It's just that it's newer and thus we're still learning how to deal with those scams. And that's what makes it scary, because there's a lot of risk with something that's new. People are innovating on ways to scam you on something that's new. Whereas like if someone calls you and like, hello, this is for your car insurance. Like, I don't have a fucking car. Like, you know, like I'm not going to answer that.
I say this all the time. I'm like, scams exist everywhere. Scams are completely agnostic to tech. And actually they live more so on the bleeding edge. So, you know, when social commerce first became big in like the late 2000s, like in 2008, my dad wouldn't let me use his credit card on the internet because he thought, yeah, like because he was like, I'm going to be defrauded. And
yeah, I was like, yeah, and then the bank will give you a new card.
Yeah. And I was like, that's just so dumb because like the chance of that happening, blah, blah, blah. But I couldn't convince him. And you know, 10 years later or 15 years later, like most things he buys are online. He receives most of the payments for his business online. You know, it's going to take that generational trend. Yeah,
exactly. And I think with NFTs, just because like, you know, you click one wrong thing and everything could be gone. I get that. That's really scary. So a lot of people say that. And I think that's the hesitation for a lot of artists. They're like, I know myself, I would do that. And I'd be so upset. And I'm like, well, this is what you could do to kind of build around that. And then, you know, also not being precious about things that you own is important too. You know, someone could break into your home at any point and take all your things as well. So I try to, you know, level it with that. I would say the biggest, most recent point of friction, kind of circling back to AI, a lot of artists, especially digital artists, are like, oh God, people, when I tell people I'm a digital artist, they just think that a computer does everything for me. And now that there's kind of a computer that can create an image from scratch, like that's what people think. And it's just going to devalue, you know, digital artwork. And I was like, no, that's not what people have thought. If you try playing with AI visually, you will know it's very difficult to get something that is worthwhile. you get a lot of duds before you find something that is semi-decent. And obviously, as AI evolves, that will get a bit better. But it's just a tool. I think that a lot of people, right, again, are scared. And I get it. Change is scary. I don't know anyone that loves change. I think people just deal with it better than others. So this is a big change. So I think that there's a lot of friction there. I always have friction in my own life of change. When I moved from New York to LA, or the day before we left, I was crying. I was like, are we making the right choice? It's like, oh, I don't know. So I get it. So I have empathy for the fact that change is scary. So I think that's really all it is. Whenever I talk to other artists, and, you know, some people have to go on their own timelines. It's like, you know, people that were like very anti-NFTs a few years ago are like, oh, I could see how this makes sense for my practice now. So that's what I tell people. It's like, you don't have to do something because it's trending. Do it when it makes sense for you, whether that's AI or NFTs, or you might not do either and like live your best life. There are a lot of artists that don't use social media and they're doing great, you know? So I think that you just have to, you know, make that decision for yourself and just try to evaluate, are you afraid of it or are you just not ready to use it yet? And I think that's a differentiator that I try to do whenever I experiment with something new.
Awesome. Well, we round off the show usually, Amber, by asking 4 quick fire questions. I'm going to let Christine do them because she wrote them all and I would feel unfair if I stole any of them. So Christine, over to you.
That is Pet's way of saying some of these are odd and Christine should ask that. That's hilarious. because I came with one written and the other 3 have been inspired by this conversation. So we'll start with the easy one, which is, do you do any art collecting yourself? If so, what artists are you enjoying these days?
Oh, I love arts now that we live in more than one room. It's going to be fun to fill the walls. Some of my favorite artists as of late are Brittany Pierre. She's a photographer. I really love her work. Leslie Granger is a painter. I've got two of her paintings in my studio. I love them. She does a lot of beautiful, large paintings too. But, you know, I bought those when I lived in New York and I was like, that's large. Her New York apartment. Another artist that I love, her name is Sarana. I'm blanking on her last name, but she also goes by Aslan Ruby as a pen name, if you will. I really love her work. She's been recently doing a lot of like abstract figurative work with multiple figures, and the forms are really beautiful. And then one of my good friends, Sarah Bauman, she is the artist behind Women and Weapons. And I really love the fact that she created a collection that, you know, does a visual metaphor for like the armor and weaponry women have to wear out into the world. I think that's a really great story, and that's something that really resonates with me. So I love all of their work.
I love that. Listeners, go check out all those people. Follow their art. Second question, how many national parks do you have left to visit? Are you counting?
Yeah, I am counting. I think I've been to 30. And they keep adding them, which is great. They keep adding parks, which I'm like, yay, good. But also not great for my goal. I think there are 60. So I'm about halfway, give or take.
Okay. This is a follow-up question because my fourth question was like, what pieces of art do you have on your walls? But you already answered that.
I mean, the other side is just a painting that I made because my office echoes. And I need something. So
What has been your favorite national park so far?
That changes often. But I'd say Petrified Forest. It's not a forest. Mm. It looks like Mars. It used to be a forest, and then the trees fell, were covered with water, were crystallized or petrified, essentially, then came back to the surface, and they're all like these beautiful crystal like rods.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I bought a little, it's in the living room. That's the negative about living in more than one space, more than one room, is that the things that you want to talk about on your kitchen table. But I bought like a little piece of petrified wood, and it essentially is a rock. It's like a crystallized piece of wood. It's really beautiful. So that's my favorite.
It's amazing. And that's a perfect segue into my final question, is that now that you don't have to use your kitchen table for a studio,
I eat there.
What do you do there? And what is the favorite meal that you have had there so far?
Oh my God. Yeah, I eat there, which is great. I would say that I really love Kazunori. There's one in New York. But there's also one in LA. And it's just sushi. It's just hand rolls. And they're very good. Dave and I are learning how to cook more. I feel like when your kitchen is like 3 feet, kind of hard to cook outside of the basics. So we're going to try to experiment a little bit more so we could do takeout less. But I love Kazunori, so that's my favorite meal there.
Perfect. I love it. And I think that brings us to the end of our quickfire questions.
You survived.
I promise they were weird, but
I can never do quickfire questions. I always like answer very long and drawn out, as you can tell.
Very well asked and very well answered. Thank you very much. Amber, before we wrap up, why don't you tell our listeners where they can find out more about yourself?
Yeah, I am very much online, for better or for worse. You can find me on almost all social media. It's just Amber_Vittoria. My last name spelled V's and Victor, Ittoria. It is Italian. My favorite thing is when people are like, what's your last name? I'm like, Vittoria. They're like, your last name. And I was like, unless something changed, that is my last name. I'm such an asshole. But yeah, so you can find me on social media, my website, ambervittoria.com. I also have an email newsletter, which I just started, which is exciting. So the sign up details for that, if you go to my social, I have a link tree. It's in there. It's also on my website. So I would love for people to sign up. I'm starting to do a bit more long form writing there, just kind of sharing about my practice. So maybe once a week, once every other week, I'll send out a newsletter.
Amazing. Covering all bases, eh?
Yes, all the online bases. Yeah.
All you needed was somewhere to eat, right? And now productivity is just like
through the roof.
Through the roof. Well, you can find us at The Floorcast, at The Floorcast, and you can find Floor at Floor on Twitter. And Christine, where can people find out more about you?
At Christine_Hall, but also at Floor if you shoot us a DM. 50-50 chance it's me on the other side.
And through the Floor app as well?
Oh, yeah. We have, you can chat with us in app, and also 50-50 chance that that is me chatting with you in the app. So it's how I make friends, you know?
If you folks haven't subscribed to the Floorcast already, please do so and give us 5 stars. Or if you thought this wasn't that great, then give us your honest feedback. And just remember that none of what we have said in this episode or any episodes is financial advice. It's just great advice. Thanks very much for listening to the Floorcast. We'll have more content for you next week.